My grandma Scott always used to tell a story of a little boy that was taught the valuable lesson of cleaning your plate before you get up from the dinner table. On one particular occasion, as he came to the end of his meal, he had a little bit of gravy left over. So he asked for a piece of bread. When he took that bread and cleaned up the gravy, he had some bread left over. So he asked for a little more gravy. When he finally cleaned up the bread, he had a little gravy left over. And this cycle continued until finally his parents recognized that their son was not looking so good. And they asked him, "What's wrong with you?" And he acknowledged, he said, "I was full a long time ago, but I was just trying to clean up my plate." How many of you were taught that lesson growing up, that you clean up your plate before you get up from the dinner table? How many of you teach that to your children? Yeah, maybe a few of you. I don't know about you, but I've always wondered, as I've gotten older, the reason for that lesson. So as you get older, you realize that by eating all of your food here in America, it does not directly feed the hungry kids in Africa. It has no effect on them. You also realize that if you happen to waste a little bit of food, of scraps, that it does not seem to affect the abundance of food that will be available to you and for you at the next meal. And so I've kind of always wondered where this analogy even came from. And what I learned this week is that it actually began in December of 1917 when Herbert Hoover was the first food administrator in the United States of America before he became president. And he issued what is known as the Clean Your Plate campaign. He did this because in 1917 our allies were fighting in what was known as the Great War. And so much of Europe was under control of other nations, and so any crops that they had been ravaged through the sake of war, and any farmers that they had to replenish the crops that were lost, they were at war. And so by the end of this war, Herbert Hoover recognized that our allies would have a low supply of food. So he instituted the Clean Your Plate campaign, and this is a flyer that you might have seen outside of a food establishment when you go to eat, to clean your plate. Because here's what he recognized, that as we clean our plate here, it allowed us at the end of that war to consume food, and the food and crops that have been consumed, we're actually able to send to Europe to help feed the ravaged the ravaged condition of that country and those various nations. And so I think we learned something significant, is that in the Clean Your Plate campaign, we learned to shift. We learned to move from living in a famine where there's in a feast where there is an abundance, to learning what it's like to live in a famine where there is a low supply. Now, I don't know how you feel, but when I approach Thanksgiving, and I think you might be the same way, I typically do not think of a Thanksgiving famine. I think of a Thanksgiving feast. I think of the abundance of food that we all will have on our tables, that we all will end up eating on for days upon days and feed us many times over. And it's out of that abundance that we give thanks. So the more abundance that we have, the more thankful that we feel and become. But what I recognize is that as God's people, Thanksgiving is never limited to the feast of our lives. Is that Thanksgiving actually comes out of the famine of our lives. If you don't believe me, think of the story of Jesus when he fed the 5,000 men, about 15,000 if you include the women and children, with 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish. If you ask me, that's a famine. 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish, that's a low supply that's in high demand. And what did he do? He took the loaves of bread and 2 fish, he looked toward heaven, and what did he do? Gave thanks. You see, I think if we're not careful, we only learn to give thanks when there's an abundance. And we don't learn to give thanks when there's a low supply. And if we never give thanks when there's a low supply, we will never have reason to give thanks when there's an abundance. And so what I recognize is that not for all of us, but for some of us, you may arrive at Thanksgiving this year differently. You may arrive at a time when you're in the middle of a famine rather than a feast. So while all the other people are enjoying the homemade noodles, you're stuck eating ramen noodles. While others are enjoying a nice Kentucky ham, you open another box of Hamburger Helper. While others get to enjoy mashed potatoes, you open another bag of chips. While others are enjoying that warm pumpkin pie with just a dab of Cool Whip on the top, you open the last one of a moon pie. Hear me this morning. I'm not talking about how much money we bring in. I'm not talking about whether we experience poverty or not. What I'm talking about is that there are times we arrive at Thanksgiving and we are crying while everybody else is celebrating. Our marriage is holding on by a thread while everybody else seems to be overflowing. We are living and just scraping by with the finances that we have while everybody around us seems to be spending frivolously. Just remember, sometimes they're just putting it on a card frivolously and they'll have to pay that back. But sometimes we arrive in the middle of Thanksgiving where everybody else has a job to be thankful for, but ours is a struggle every single day. Where everybody else's kids come to church and obeying the Lord, but our kids are not, and we pray for them every day. Where everybody else is getting married, but we remain single. Everybody else gets kids, but we're struggling to have our own. You fill in the blank. I think sometimes we arrive at Thanksgiving not in a mode of feast. We arrive at Thanksgiving in a mode of famine. And how do we give thanks in the midst of that? I want to tell you this. If you find yourself in a famine, I believe you are in the best position to learn the secret of Thanksgiving. Because when you and I are in a feast, we give thanks for what we did, what we accomplished, what we earned. But when you are in a famine, you only give thanks for what God did, for what God multiplied, for what God touched, for what God blessed. Oh, you're not with me. That's okay. I didn't plan on you being there. I'm telling you, this is a deep shift of our faith. And I want to learn and I want to teach from 1 Kings chapter 17 to be able to do that. 1 Kings chapter 17 and verse 1 says, "Now Elijah the Tishbite from Tishbe in Gilead said to Ahab, 'As the Lord, the God of Israel, lives whom I serve, there will be neither dew nor rain in the next few years, except at my word.'" Let's point out the obvious. There was going to be a famine in the land. If there's not rain, there are not crops. And if there are not crops, there is not food. And food is kind of in high demand. You know that? You know how I know? Because if I preach too long on a Sunday morning, I know how high demand that food becomes. But there'll be a low supply. It's a famine. But this is more than just a famine from food. This is a God famine. You see, the person that Elijah goes and speaks to, who did he speak to? He said to Ahab. If you back up into chapter 16, King Ahab is the most evil king Israel has ever had. Now that's saying something, because if you read through the book of 1 Kings, it will say this king did evil in the eyes of the Lord, evil in the eyes of the Lord, evil in the eyes of the Lord. Then you dab one or two in there, did good in the eyes of the Lord, and then evil. There were a lot of kings he was in competition with. But his fall was he followed the sins of past kings, in particular the king Jeroboam and his sins of idolatry. But then his biggest sin, husbands, don't you say a word, was his wife, Jezebel. Not only was he the most evil king Israel had ever seen, he married the most evil woman anybody has ever known. How many of you know someone named Jezebel? I hope no one. Because even those who are non-religious know that you don't name your child Jezebel because the reputation goes before her even thousands of years later. You see, here was the downfall, is that Jezebel had a one-life mission, and here's what it was. It was to get Yahweh, the God of Israel, out and to get Baal in as their God. Here was Ahab's fault. He allowed her to do it. Now, here's what's interesting. The worship of Baal. Baal is a fertility god. Baal is the one who sends rain upon the land. Oh, you don't hear it. You don't see it yet. You see what God's doing? Israel decides to worship a fertility god named Baal, who's supposed to send rain on the land, which would have been in autumn, which is their early rain, and then in the spring, which is their late rain. They only received it about two times a year, but that was enough for their crops. And so here was what Israel was doing. They were making sure that in case God came short, that they had a backup plan to substitute in. In case God didn't send His rain, they could worship Baal and Baal would send rain instead of them. Now what's interesting to me is that if you go into the book of Deuteronomy, Deuteronomy chapter 11, God makes a promise. He said, if you faithfully obey me, I will send rain upon your land in season, in autumn and in spring, so that you can have grain and new wine. And then at the end in Deuteronomy chapter 28, this is the chapter of blessings and curses. If you obey God, He will bless you. If you disobey God, He will curse you. And you know what one of the curses of disobedience was? I will make the sky like bronze and the ground like iron. You see what this was about? This was about a God and who would show up. You see, sometimes the famine has nothing to do with food and everything to do with God. Sometimes we have to learn to give thanks for a God of famine. See, sometimes God will come in short supply. We will pray for God to heal, and He'll do it some other way. It's not that He doesn't do it, but it's not the answer we wanted. And you might say that we're in a God famine. God came up short this time in my prayers. Our finances might be in a mess, so we decide this time we're going to obey God and we're going to fix the finances by giving. And God doesn't send that big check that bails us out. And we might say God has come up short, that we're worshiping a God of famine, for His supply seems to be low. We decide to share our faith, and we get rejected. We get called into the principal's office, the supervisor's office. And no one converts when we share our faith, and we say, God, I did what You told me to do, and I find myself in low supply. Decide to raise our kids in church, teaching them the ways of God. One is following and one isn't. Raised in the same household, raised under the same truths. You've done all that you could do, and you still have prodigals. And you want to say, I know I'm not perfect, but I did everything I could do, and God seemed to come up short of what He needed to do. I'm preaching to somebody, but by the looks of your faces, I can't tell who yet. You've been there. You see, it's one thing to give thanks to a God of an abundance. It's hard to give thanks to a God in a famine. See, here's what I find interesting. Elijah did exactly what he was told by the Lord to do. And if you, when we get into the next verse, here's what you will find. He has to run for his life. He has to hide, and he too is in the middle of famine. He did everything he was supposed to do, and God seems to come up short on appearances only. Well, I have good news for you. I think you're getting there. Oh, I have one more on this. See, here's what happens when we have a God of low supply. We start substituting in other gods to make up the difference. That's idolatry. See, when you know, we're supposed to love our enemies and we return good for evil and things get worse instead of getting better, we just substitute our own theology and say, well, that don't work, so we might as well return evil for evil. Well, when I gave trying to fix my finances and that didn't work, I might as well just work harder or borrow more. Because God's proven He can't provide. And we all have these substitutes. And probably we all have a singular substitute that we run to every time God seems to not be doing His part. It's the way we make up for it. It's the way we escape the emotions that are associated with it. All right, I think I've told you enough about the bad news. Here's the good news. Even in the famine, we can give thanks. Even in the famine, we can give thanks. I'm going to work through this. In the famine, we give thanks. Why? Because God has a plan for you. Verse 2, then the word of the Lord came to Elijah. You know what God's plan is? It's always God's word. Because you know what God's word is? It's a promise. It's a promise. And we can put our trust in the promise. Now, here's the problem with God's plan. It comes a word at a time. It comes a step at a time. You ain't going to know where you're going when you start following God. You won't know the exact place that He's going to work this out. Most of the time, the only thing you know is the step that's right in front of you. And you won't see step two until you take step one. That's good preaching, preacher. You will never know what is next until you take the next step. Proverbs 16:9 says, we make our plans, we have our destination, but the Lord determines our steps. One step, one word at a time. And so in the famine, the word of God will come to you, and I believe it will come to you in a promise. And we will either take our next step and live as if that promise is true, or we will start living as if that promise isn't true. The choice will be ours. Here's the question I want to ask. When is the last time you could say this? The word of the Lord came to Jonathan. Elijah was a man. He was a righteous man. As the saying goes, he probably put his pants on one leg at a time. Just like we do. He was an ordinary man that the word of the Lord came to. Here's what I want you to know. When you are in the famine, the word of the Lord will come. And it will be a promise. It will be a word that will sustain you through the famine that you're in. For Jesus quoted Deuteronomy when he said, man does not live on bread alone, but on every word that comes out of the mouth of God. It'll be a word tailored to you and to no one else. You'll speak it and they'll think you're nuts. It don't matter what other people think. It's a word for you. And when it hits, it's like lightning. You know it. You can't make it happen. It will come out of the blue. Something someone says. A song, a lyric on the radio. Maybe every now and then something the preacher says. And you'll probably say it to me and I'll be like, I didn't ever said that. Because I won't even remember it. And what will happen is that word will start surfacing. It'll be highlighted everywhere you go. It's like when you buy a car a certain color. You never saw that color before until you saw it the first time, and now it's everywhere. You didn't see the word everywhere else, but once you hear it the first time and know that it's for you, it will repeat itself over and over and over because God has a plan for you in the famine. Second. Or I don't know, it's not in order. In the famine, God has a plan to protect you. Here's what he said to Elijah. Leave here, turn eastward, and hide in the Kerith Ravine, east of the Jordan. Sometimes we think that when we follow the plan of God, we will not be in fear. Elijah had every reason to be in fear. One, because of Ahab. So go into 1 Kings chapter 18, verse 17, I believe that it is. Yep, that is correct. And the next time Ahab sees Elijah, he said, oh, here comes the troubler of Israel. In other words, everything that's happened to our nation, it's your fault, Elijah. So if you have a king that's against you, all the people in the land that are against you, and you have a mean-spirited woman who wants to kill you and annihilate every prophet of the Lord off the face of the earth, you have a reason to be afraid. And so what God tells him to do is to go hide in a place where even though the evil is present, it can't get to him. To go to a place where it cannot overcome him. Where it doesn't have to define him. You see, we have to learn to give thanks in the famine sometimes based on what God keeps from us. Here's the problem. We don't always know what He protects us from. Sometimes God will stop something in heaven before it makes it to earth, and we have no idea that it was even a possibility coming for us. There are times that God will delay our life. We think we're running late. We think we're behind our own accomplished goals, and you're going to wind up right on time every time because He's protecting something from us. Can I tell you, we only give God discredit when He doesn't perform the miracles we want. And I preach this all the time. We have to give God credit for miracles we will never know about this side of eternity. And so sometimes what we realize is, God, I know that You are my help, You are my shield, You are my light and my salvation. Of whom shall I be afraid? Even when I am afraid, it is Your love, Your perfect love, that cast out all fear. Now when God protects us, let me be clear on this, it doesn't mean He keeps us from suffering. He protects the suffering. He protects our joy from being stolen by the suffering. He doesn't protect us from storms. He protects us from our peace being robbed by the storm. He doesn't keep temptations from us, but He will protect our character in the midst of the temptation. It doesn't even mean we won't sin. It just means that when we do, He will protect sin from stealing and taking away our salvation. That it will not become a pattern that will form in our life. That we don't have to be defined by the famine that we're in. It does not have to dictate our decisions. It does not have to steal our identity. We are still a child of God. In the famine, God has a plan to provide for you. You will drink from the brook, and I have directed the ravens to supply you with food there. Notice something. Elijah doesn't get to pick the menu. He doesn't get to determine what the food is. He doesn't get to determine what he gets to drink. He only gets what the Lord determines to provide for him. Let's have a reminder. Rarely will God provide us with what we want. But God will always provide us with what we need. And when He provides us with what we need, we realize that's what we wanted all along. In the famine, God has a plan to provide for you. I can't tell you this morning how He will provide. I can only tell you that He will provide. I don't take this for granted, but I recognize today that the grace of God has always been a part of my life. That unlike some people in our world and in our nation, my refrigerator and cabinets have always had food in them. Not always the food I wanted, but food. I know this isn't true for every single person, but I've never had to worry about the power being turned off. And I don't take that for granted. I didn't deserve to grow up that way any more than sometimes other people, that's how they grew up. They don't deserve that either. But I can tell you, I can tell you in the past year about times when hospital bills arrived and on an income, a single income, we weren't sure how they'd be paid. And never was there a time that a bunch of money showed up just to pay for those bills. I don't even remember all the ways it was just a little here and a little there. And it's easy in a year's time to forget that you even had them. All I know is my God provided. I could tell you of a time that we drove to see some friends in Missouri, and unbeknownst to us, our water pump was starting to leak. And it just so happens that my friend is a mechanic. He noticed the little red dot in his driveway. He pulled it in and we looked it up. It'd be about a $600 job if I was paying somebody to do it. I didn't have $600. I had $100 that paid for the parts and a friend that was willing to put them on for free. A job I could not do. See, I can't tell you every time how God will provide. I can only tell you that He will. You see, I grew up on a hymn of the church that sings, "Great is Thy faithfulness. Great is Thy faithfulness. Morning by morning, new mercies I see." Lamentations 3. "All I have needed, Thy hands have provided. Great is Thy faithfulness, Lord, unto me." I can only echo what the psalmist says, "I have never seen the righteous forsaken." So how do we live in all of this? Very simply, we take God's promise, we act on His promise, and there will be a feast. Verse 5, "So he did what the Lord told him." Now that is not an insignificant verse. Because the last time Elijah did what the Lord told him to do, he found himself in a valley, afraid and in a famine, not knowing where his next meal was going to come from for the next few years. I would have done a time out and say, "I'm not sure, God. You told me to do this last time. It didn't work out so well." But he did what the Lord told him to do. You know what that means? He lived his life as if the promise God had given him was true, because it was. He lived his life as if the promise had already happened, even though he was waiting for it to arrive. So he went to the Kerith Ravine, east of the Jordan, and stayed there. The ravens brought him bread and meat in the morning, and bread and meat in the evening, and he drank from the brook. Elijah did not get bread until he left where he was and did what God told him. Elijah did not get his water supply met until he did and went where God told him to go. Sometimes we will never come into the provision of God until we do what He's telling us to do. Now hear me, this is not suggesting that just because we obey, He provides every time. This is not a works-based system. This is a faith and works working together. Because here's what you have to do. You first have to receive the promise. Then when you receive the promise, you live as if the promise is already true, because it is. That's action. And then God will provide. Sometimes God won't provide when we keep doing the same things over and over and over. Sometimes God won't make any changes until we make the change He's calling us to make. Oh, I could go a long way on that, but I'm not going to. Here's what I want to challenge you to do. Whatever your famine and whatever your promise, live as if the promise is true. Make your decisions as if God has already provided, because He has. Make your decisions not out of fear, but knowing that you're protected, because you are. You see, that changes the way God's people live in the middle of famine. It's radical, it's uncomfortable, it's uneasy, but it is the way of God. It is the way that we encounter Him in the middle of a valley that we've never been able to encounter Him before. So you're in the dark, go ahead and live as if you're in the light, because the light has come and it's coming for you. You're in the middle of a battle, you see defeat all the way around you, you see no way out of this alive. Live as if you've already won, because you have. It just hasn't come yet. You're praying for prodigals. You're sharing your faith and you've not seen anyone come to salvation. they will. For God's desire is that no one will perish. Keep sharing. Keep believing. Keep being faithful to Him, because He surely and certainly is faithful to us.